This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hilton Alls has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1994. Officially, he's the magazine's theater critic, but he knows about pretty much everything that goes on in the city culturally. In particular, he reads a lot of poetry. Recently, he went to visit a poet named Brenda Shaughnessy.
Could this wallpaper be any worse?
At the house she had just moved into in New Jersey.
Brenda, you have a whole house.
And there are like four bedrooms on the first floor, so we all have a place.
She lives there with her husband, Craig Morgan Teicher, who's also a poet, and their two kids.
How old is he now?
He's eight.
Oh, my God, Cal.
Cal, Shaughnessy's eight-year-old, has cerebral palsy. And that's one of the reasons that they left New York City.
If the landlady is like, oh, we're going to raise the rent $2,000, we couldn't be like, well, let's find someplace else. Like, we can't,
you can't do that.
I mean, we had to have a ground floor apartment or an elevator building because this wheelchair, you can't get upstairs,
right.
You know.
Right.
Shaughnessy wrote about living with and loving a disabled child in her last book, Our Andromeda. Her new book is about coming of age and her life in the city as a young gay woman, before kids, before marriage. And I do want to mention in her conversation with Hilton, Shaughnessy does use some choice words to describe gay life in that period. So the book is a kind of a memoir, and she did a lot of her best thinking, she told Hilton, in the swimming pool.
I do this thing when I go swimming. I do laps, and I count my laps. 1, 2, 3, and each lap as I'm swimming it, I relive that year of my life.
Oh, wow.
So I imagine...
That's what you do in the first poem of your new book, when you do the time travel, right?
Yes.
And you say that when you time travel, suddenly you're yourself consumed by shame and embarrassment for having lost a library book.
Those little flashes of memory,
yes,
are ones that have come up when I've been swimming. And then right around the time I'm super tired, around 11 or 12, is also when things get kind of bad. You know, like then pubescence happens and suddenly you're like, this is terrible. I got to get through these years. And so you are motivated to keep swimming and to get past that time and get to where it gets sort of more interesting again. So we're around 18, 19, around college time, things start getting a little more fun. Over the years, different memories have popped up that I've used in poems.
This new book of poems begins with a poem that the New Yorker published that has that kind of forward and backward movement at the same time that I love so much about your writing. Would you mind reading it?
Sure.
Okay.
I have a time machine, but unfortunately, it can only travel into the future at a rate of 1 second per second, which seems slow to the physicists and to the grant committees, and even to me. But I managed to get there, time after time, to the next moment and to the next. Thing is, I can't turn it off. I keep zipping ahead, well, not zipping. And if I try to get out of this time machine, open the latch, I'll fall into space, unconscious, then desiccated. And I'm pretty sure I'm afraid of that. So I stay inside. There's a window, though. It shows the past. It's like a television or a fish tank, but it's never live. It's always over. The fish swim in backward circles. Sometimes it's like a rearview mirror, another chance to see what I'm leaving behind, and sometimes like blackout, all that time wasted sleeping. Myself, age 8, whole head burnt with embarrassment at having lost a library book. Myself, lurking in a candled corner, expecting to be found charming. Me, holding a rose, though I want to put it down so I can smoke. Me, exploding at my mother, who explodes at me, because the explosion of some dark star all the way back struck hard at mother's mother's mother. I turn away from the window, anticipating a blow. I thought I'd find myself an old woman by now, traveling so light in time. But I haven't gotten far at all. Strange not to be able to pick up the pace as I'd like. The past is so horribly fast.
Gorgeous. How long did you work on that piece?
I had a really strange experience last summer in which most of this book came to be, which is that I started taking singing lessons.
That's so crazy.
Yeah, it was a really weird thing because I'm not a singer and I'm not a good singer. And it's not like I want to be on The Voice or anything. It's not like I'm trying to like have a second career here. I've never let it rip, you know, never once in my life. You know, maybe on like a roller coaster. Have I ever like really done that? But never really. And the other thing, too, is that I've always sang to Cal. He's always been very comforted, even when he was a colicky baby. He's always been very comforted when I sing. But I can't, he's not comforted if I phone it in. I have to bring all of it.
It has to be the guts.
He really wants me to like, he wants me to do like the full on like Broadway Annie kind of thing. And from the very first lesson, I started going home and writing obsessively. It was like it unleashed my, I mean, It unclogged my voice. I felt like I could say anything. I was no longer afraid of what I sounded like.
Give us the title of your new book.
The new book is So Much Synth. A lot of the book is set in pubescence and adolescence. And so when I was 12, 13, 14-ish, it was the 80s. It was the early 80s where like all the music had like laser sounds and just full on synth keyboards. And it was supposed to sound cold and robotic and futuristic, right? Because we all thought we were entering this robot age. And the poem, this long poem is called Is There Something I Should Know? Which is a title of a Duran Duran song.
It's interesting because in the second part of the book, there's a sort of struggle going on between the narrator of some of the poems, those very intense short poems, and objects of desire, particularly a young, another girl, it feels like.
Yeah, so the second part, and that's sort of tracing my sort of decade in New York as, you know, as an out lesbian, I moved to New York City with my college girlfriend because she was going to grad school for a PhD program, and we were so in love. You know, of course I was going to move to New York with her. And I had $1,000. And I was like, I'm going to be fine. I have $1,000. Like, what more could I possibly have in my suitcase? And I have $1,000, everybody. I have so much money. It just never even occurred to me that that wasn't, you know, my grandfather in Okinawa had given that as a college graduation gift.
Wow.
And I'm like, I'm fine.
I'm set. I'm totally set.
Except forever.
Yeah.
And then 6 weeks in, she dumped me. So I had to find another place. And the place I found was this dyke loft in Tribeca.
Yes.
And it was really fun. And we would go to all those great lesbian clubs that used to exist that don't anymore.
Would you read another from that section?
There's only a few.
Yeah.
Well, one is about, as you know, that Melissa Etheridge song that was like on nonstop. Do you remember this one? When everyone was playing But I'm the Only One by Melissa Etheridge like all the time. It was just on everywhere.
Yes.
But it's too long to read.
How about the first page?
But I'm the Only One. Who'd Walk Across a Fire for You, growled Melissa. That song blared from all four of our bedroom's tape decks, often simultaneously, as if that song was the only one we all loved. the only one we could agree on that summer in the Dyke Loft, just when it all started to change. Catherine was moving out to Soho to live with Melanie, so Shiggy's girlfriend DM took her room. But not for long. They broke up and Michelle moved in shortly after Cynthia came. Tonight you told me that you ache for something new. This was way before we'd even dreamed we'd have to rent out Shiggy's office to Aaron as a fifth bedroom. Without Catherine, we couldn't afford the loft, but we didn't know that yet. At the time, we thought everyone was poor like us. We weren't the only ones. We all smoked constantly. Anyone could afford to smoke back then. Catherine bummed my last butt, but I know I saw her new carton in the freezer. She didn't want to open it yet. She was trying to cut back. This was before we almost got the gas cut off, before we lost electricity the first of many times, after Justine had been bullied out with her three cats. But Kristen, whom we suspected was asexual and not really lesbian, was still hanging on, even though she adopted yet another cat into the loft without asking. It was only one more, she reasoned, but we already had Seether, Amber, Balzac, Gigli, and now Evaluna. Anna and Jackie came by. They were friendly to me, but Jet and Julie weren't. T&J were Clit Club, A&J were literary. Then Michelle and Shiggy secretly slept together, a disaster, and Cynthia got kicked out for being bi and then bringing a guy to the loft.
You then met Craig, and your life changed. Just in the poet circles? Or?
Yeah, just in the poet circles.
Did you always feel that you wanted to have children, Brenda?
I don't know. I think I liked kids and I wanted to have kids. I didn't think I would ever be stable enough to have a kid.
Yes.
And I didn't think I would ever have a partner that I could trust enough to have a child with.
Yes.
But now that I have these two kids, I find myself more and more obsessed with time, mm-hmm. with death.
Because you're here to protect them from mortality, yeah. in a certain way,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, and wanting to make sure I give them what they need.
Yes.
You know, everybody... It's hard for anybody to reconcile the fact that your child is disabled. You know,
yes.
It's just like, you know, one of the key things of being a parent, you want your kid to be able to do all these things,
sure.
and have their options. And when your child can't walk or can't talk, it's sort of accepting those limitations on his behalf is very
yes.
difficult.
Yes.
And then the older I get and the more of my friends and peers I see who have grown children, who have various kinds of mental illnesses,
yes.
I think, you know, we all have disabilities everywhere,
yes.
and none of us really have all the options open to us.
That's
you know,
right.
it's Cal has these very specific major ones, but it doesn't necessarily prevent him from living a full spiritual life,
right.
from loving and feeling and... He's mastered this other ability to, like, lift skirts. It's a horribly embarrassing. It isn't to me, and I know how to do it, but he'll do it to people on the street. And I'm just like, that is not, of all the things to use your limited motor skills on, can
right.
you just come up with something different than that?
That's funny.
But I don't know what his outlook is going to be. And what's so shocking to me is that the same is true for my... completely typically developing daughter.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, she's going to go out into the world. I don't know what's going to happen. And the whole thing is just horribly frightening. I have to feel hopeful and excited for my kids' futures.
Yes. It's the thing that makes you get up and say...
Well, you have to get up. You will yell and scream until you get up. Someone, I don't know who said this, it's very cruel, but like every kid you have, that's a book you didn't write.
Wow.
You know, some idea around how they take your energy, and they do take your energy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think even if you don't have kids, even if you only have one job, even if you're only doing one thing, like how do we do it all?
Yeah.
There's actually too much to do all the time. It's always been a huge mystery to me that we all have the same amount of time.
Yeah.
You know, when you say, oh, I don't have time to do that, it's like, well, you have the same amount of time as I do. So
yes.
if I have time, then, you know, then why not?
The poet Brenda Shaughnessy talking with The New Yorker's Hilton Alls. She teaches at Rutgers University, and her book of poems, So Much Synth, comes out a little later this spring.